I will call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. The quorum having come and gone, actually quorum is present, and the first order of business would be the approval of minutes from April 2nd. Chair would entertain a motion to that effect.
No move.
Representative Falk moves approval of the minutes. Are there any, is there any discussion, any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have one bill on the agenda for today. Representative Bly's House File 932. Given that we are obviously quite short of time today and do not have a particularly busy agenda for next week, what we're going to do is hear as much testimony as we can on the bill today, go till 4:30, and then we will lay the bill over for further testimony and consideration on the next meeting, which would be April 15th. So Representative Bly, time's a wasting. Representative Bly, if you would move the bill for consideration.
Chair Healthy and members, I'd like to move House File 932. I think we're laying this bill over, is that correct, until Wednesday? I guess that's the motion to be made.
That does not need to be included in the motion. We just need to have the bill before us.
Okay. I do have an amendment.
The amendment appears to be technical in nature. Do you want to explain the amendment briefly?
This is Amendment 932A2, and essentially there was, I think, an error in the naming of Subdivision 3, page 4, line 17. Subdivision 3 was referenced when it should have been 4, and then we were missing a line that explained that if with the equalization payments, when they're received, they should be remitted to the ratepayers in full. So essentially that gets us still into the shape that I want it to be in.
Representative Bly moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Bly, to your bill.
Yes.
As amended.
This bill is a bill that I believe would, if passed, would promote renewable energy, would create local economic development, would encourage dispersed generation, would deal with our greenhouse gas problem and protect the environment. And I'll have some testifiers who will speak to some of those issues as we go forward. Some things have changed since the last time I, not just with my bill, but with the position of this policy, renewable energy payment policy, sometimes called a feed-in tariff. There have been numerous states that have introduced similar policy, and in the city of Gainesville, Florida, they have actually implemented a policy like this and are very pleased with the way things are going with that. In addition, the province of Ontario has instituted a similar provision. There are some other proposals that do a kind of partial feed-in tariff or renewable energy payment. So this policy is moving forward across North America and has been very popular and used to a great extent in Europe with much success. In Germany, they have shown, I think, that it's a cost-effective way to promote renewable energy and accomplish many of the goals that I've described. And so without further ado, let's take a look at the bill. The bill does outline the purposes or goals that I would hope to accomplish pretty well in the statement of purposes, which I kind of summarized for you. And then the section of definitions, and then it talks about how the tariff would be established, and that this tariff would make it possible for the utilities to purchase the energy produced by smaller solar and wind projects. As you can see, there's a schedule for the prices. The prices for wind and solar, the way that they're laid out, the first couple of years they would be set for a 20-year period at that level, and then they would degress. That's the technical term that the Germans developed, so that taking into account the technical improvements and the reduction in prices of the materials, you wouldn't need to keep the prices the way they are. They would become more reasonable. But the point of having the prices the way they are is to make sure that people investing can get a return so that it becomes affordable for them to do. So it's important that price be set high enough that that can happen. And I'll have some testifiers come up and talk about how that might work and the impact of those prices on ratepayers and how that might all come about. The other thing is that we have in the bill a plan to equalize the charges and payments, which has to do with making sure that there's no one region or area that provides the energy, a utility or a co-op would have to adjust for the increases in the cost. It would be spread over the state, and that's what the equalization has to do with. But we would be requiring that the utilities pay for this new energy, and that's what makes it work, and also provide for the interconnection. What Germany has seen and what we propose will happen if this bill is passed and implemented, that this kind of energy development and economic development could happen anywhere in the state. The sun shines in every corner and the wind blows, and I think that we would see that all kinds of people could make use of this, from individuals to small businesses to community efforts. One of the notions that I had in talking with community action centers was that perhaps in their development of housing, low-income housing, if they could, in fact, put a solar panel on a roof that they were making, they might be able to reduce the cost of the housing to the tenants who were there, because they would have some profit in order to be able to do that. I've been approached by colleges and universities who would like to implement this kind of plan to also bring down the cost of tuition. I think there are many ways that this could be a real benefit to our economy, and not only to create jobs, but to have impacts that we haven't necessarily thought about. So, without further ado, I think I'll ask my first testifier to come up. Well, let me just say that in your packet there are a number of handouts, some related to the testifiers that will come forward, also some information that's kind of general information about the policy itself. One person coming up to speak is from the Audubon Society, and you'll notice in their most recent magazine I have a copy of the editor's perspective on that, and he talks about the importance of the feed-in tariff policy for the environment, and also includes a little kind of map or display of how the feed-in tariff works, which you can look at. Some other pages that are included in this part of the packet are from publications from Germany that explain the policy of feed-in tariff and some of the benefits that they have seen from increasing jobs to other kind of economic benefits, and showing that their intent in future years is to have renewables replace the need for any nuclear energy. In fact, one of the reasons I understand that the Germans implemented the feed-in tariff for renewables was to move in that direction away from nuclear and also from coal and oil. So They look at it as a means to accelerate their ability to develop the renewable energy sources that they have. And you know, we've heard earlier that there's urgency for finding other kinds of energy sources, whether that were nuclear or whatever it might be. I think if that same urgency exists, and if we're not going to go down the nuclear path, it means that we really should find a way to increase and accelerate our development of renewable energies. And I think this policy is definitely a way to do that. Okay, I'm going to invite John Farrell to come up from the Institute of Local Self-Reliance to talk a little bit about the economics of this policy.
Representative Bly, in addition to Mr. Farrell, we have Professor Kildegard, who has traveled to be here. We also have Mr. Fredrickson, likewise. I would like to be able to accommodate them today. We have 35 minutes left.
I think
you and Mr. Farrell will be here next week. So let's try to keep that in mind as we go forward.
Yes.
Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify. My name is John Farrell, and I'm a research associate at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'll give what I hope will be brief remarks here on the renewable energy benefits and the way that the feed-in tariff program ties into economic development. My goal is to sort of cover four particular things. One, to just briefly summarize what Representative Bly already discussed in terms of the activity on feed-in tariff around the country at other state legislatures. Address the myth that a feed-in tariff is an expensive way to get to renewable energy goals. Talk about the true costs and some projections that our organization has put together for this particular bill. And talk about the real benefit about how this ties together renewable energy policy with economic development very closely. As was already mentioned, there are a number of different states already considering feed-in tariffs. Minnesota is one of six states with legislation that's pending, and there are another eight states that are considering legislation or have groups that are putting together legislation to be considered in future sessions. There is one municipal utility in Gainesville, Florida that has already implemented a feed-in tariff that has been successfully put forth, and there are already 4 megawatts of solar proposed and to be developed this year based on that successful policy. So I'll address directly one of the things that you're going to hear about later, most likely, which is the myth that a feed-in tariff is an expensive policy for renewable energy, and that primarily focuses on its support for solar photovoltaic panels. It has been said last year and will likely be said this year by members of utilities that the prices that we pay for solar are as much as 10 times higher than what we pay now. And the reason that it kind of depends on what number you're picking. And what I like to talk about this is that it's sort of an apples to oranges comparison, and that the number that the utilities are tossing out is often an average price over the course of a year for the amount that they would pay for their electricity, which is comparable to maybe what they would be paying for electricity in the nighttime period when not a lot of people are on the system, and that's the apple. The orange would be at peak times on a hot summer day when electricity is much more expensive. Utilities may be having to buy electricity from outside sources in order to meet the demands of the system. And that, coincidentally, as you see in the red shaded area, is when a solar panel is going to be producing electricity. So when we're comparing prices of electricity, we need to be comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. Solar electricity is more valuable than electricity that's produced at the nighttime, and that's why it's reasonable to pay more for it and to encourage that kind of development. So let's get down to the nuts and bolts of what this bill could mean for Minnesota. The proposal suggests that up to 20% of the state's RES could be met with the feed-in tariff, that it would focus on locally owned projects that qualify for seabed, and that it would primarily be for wind, but it would introduce some support at the state level for solar PV panels. What it would mean is that by the time that we reach our goals in 2025 of approximately 25% electricity from renewable sources, that about 24% of our electricity in the state will be in that red pie square, which is renewables that would not come in under the feed-in tariff, but would just be, according to our current mode of development, mostly large wind projects. And about 4 to 5% of our electricity would come from projects under the feed-in tariff, that small green slice, with the remainder being non-renewable sources, such as coal or nuclear. The cost per month for the average Minnesota household under this feed-in tariff. And this is in comparison to business as usual, which is with our current renewable energy standard, would be at its maximum 32 cents a month. And that's mostly because as you bring solar online in the early years when it's more expensive, it may increase prices slightly. Now, this is 32 cents a month on a utility bill that might average as much as $70. And then, as Representative Bly mentioned, these prices step down over time to account for the fact that technology is rapidly improving, and such that by 2025, it may actually be cheaper for the electricity that can be brought on by the feed-in tariff than if we had just gotten that electricity under the renewable electricity standard. There's one other thing I should say about this chart. The 32 cents a month is a very conservative and a very high estimate for what these costs can be, as will be mentioned by Professor Arne Kildegard in his testimony. And in some other testimony, there are many other components to the way that the cost of electricity operates, and there are many effects of a feed-in tariff that can help actually reduce the wholesale price of electricity. This is simply looking at the maximum possible cost that could occur to your residential rate payer. The feed-in tariff in general, then, is, as Representative Bly mentioned, there are three essential components: that it guarantees a grid connection, it would have a 20-year contract for anybody who is connecting to the grid, and it is a reasonable rate of return determines the price that we pay based on the technology. And the goal is that it's an all-in price. It's, when I plug in my solar panel, the price that I'm receiving for the utility is the sum of almost all of the incentives that I would receive, excepting perhaps the federal tax credit. And the goal of this is really to make financing of renewable energy much simpler and therefore less expensive. Right now, there are a plethora of incentives that a renewable energy entrepreneur will have to piece together in order to finance a project. A feed-in tariff puts those all in one basket into one document in that contract that they can take to the bank and get financing for. And it also helps democratize the ownership and open more opportunities for energy entrepreneurs to be energy producers instead of just consumers. One of the key reasons why this is a valuable thing to do, as this committee already knows, having heard a discussion on CVED legislation earlier this year, is that there are significant benefits to keeping energy generation local. In two counties in Minnesota on the Buffalo Ridge, we export as much as $80 million a year to states and to foreign countries who are owners of the development rather than Minnesotans. And of course, you also have problems that when people don't directly benefit from the renewable energy that's being produced in their area, they're sometimes not so excited to have it there. There have been many studies that have been done by Professor Kildegard and by many others on the benefits of local ownership. You can get, on average, about 2 times the jobs per megawatt of wind development and 4 to 5 times more economic impact. And I apologize for the silly-looking clip art, but it is very illustrative of what the differential is between local ownership and absentee ownership of renewable energy projects. It also means that people are more interested when they have a tangible benefit from a renewable energy project to having it in their backyard. And if you look at the feed-in tariff as it's proposed, and with the amount of wind that you would expect under this bill, you can see what the differential could be. With the feed-in tariff, you can double the number of jobs that would be created by those particular projects and significantly increase the economic impact to the state of Minnesota. So that's what I will leave you with. I would be more than happy to take questions. You can, if there's not time for questions today, you're welcome to contact me at the following information there. The illustration up here is a news story. For your information, the Canadian province of Ontario just recently passed a feed-in tariff, a very comprehensive program, and within 2 weeks they had commitments from a solar company to build a 150-megawatt manufacturing plant for thin film solar. And so you can see the kind of connection that is made between the economic development and renewable energy development with this kind of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Members, for the late arrivals, obviously we had to start late today. We have a couple of testifiers who have come from some distance to testify on this bill. It is not my intention to take any action on the bill today. We will try to accommodate the testifiers that we have, which there are two, and lay the bill over, and we can continue discussion at our next meeting, which will be on April 15th. So that's my intention, and I'm sure Mr. Farrell will be available. I hope Mr. Farrell will be available for questions at that time, but if you would give the people that we're trying to accommodate that courtesy, I would be grateful. So, that said, next on the list, Sister Hildegard.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today in favor of HF 932. My name is Arne Hildegard. I'm Associate Professor of Economics and Management at the University of Minnesota out in Morris. So, of course, I don't speak for the university, if that's not obvious. For several years, I've conducted research on the economics of power systems, renewable energy, and the rural economy. Since there's a lot of other talent lined up and time is short, I'm going to limit myself to a brief report on some of the recent research that's coming out comparing this policy with alternatives. Okay. Now, there are literally dozens of research papers on this subject, and virtually all of them are authored by teams of European power systems analysts, whether in industry or in academia. And the reason for this, for their Europeanness, that is that it's very simple. The European process of European unification has led to pressure to harmonize policies across the various members of the EU. And so they've had, whereas some kind of impartial analysis is a basic input into arguing for or against any specific policy and reaching a policy consensus, they're actually ahead of us in terms of policy comparison and serious policy and economic analysis of different incentive schemes for renewable energy. And so there are various strands of this research that support the case for feed-in tariffs as a renewable electricity incentive structure. I'm going to limit my remarks to summarizing some of the research on a specific aspect of cost, since I think this is where the conventional wisdom is least in touch or most at odds with what the peer-reviewed research is showing at this point. 2008, I'm going to show you three citations in a minute, looking at feed-in tariffs and research projects concluded that feed-in tariffs generate reductions in the wholesale price of power comparable to the cost of the subsidy itself. In other words, we're talking about a policy, according to these recent peer-reviewed findings, that essentially pays for itself. And even this is while, of course, it's delivering substantial renewable power investment. The finding is counterintuitive, I feel a little sheepish about this, but it's late in the afternoon. I'm afraid I have to give you a brief economics lecture. I apologize in advance. I'll keep it mercifully brief. Just because this is without it, the counterintuitive effects are not likely to be persuasive. Does this work this way? There we go. Okay, so the phenomenon I want to talk about is known in the literature as merit order effect. And so what I've basically outlined here is a sort of a caricature or a simplified version of a supply schedule. The various generation assets in the market available at any given time lined up in terms of their marginal cost. Right, so we have under MISO and the wholesale market here, we have a bidding process for eliciting the true value of marginal costs for the various owners of these generation assets. I've lined them up. I've given them names. I don't want to go to the mat for this. Some might be cheaper, more expensive than others. But just as an illustration, the marginal cost of hydro would probably be the lowest, and then nuclear, coal, et cetera. And so at the very end, as you start to get out to higher and higher quantities demanded, you have to use higher and higher marginal cost sources of generation. Okay? So, now this is a simplification in several dimensions, but it's my simplification. It's not the simplification that's in the research. The teams of researchers I'm about to show you have fully taken into account things like the marginal cost of a generator at 11 a.m. is going to be a function of how the degree to which it's dispatched at 10 a.m. There are ramping costs, startup costs, and this kind of thing. And there are also balancing costs, a variety of other costs in this market. So this is a simplification, but I think it's illustrative, and to a first approximation, it's very close to what's happening. Okay, the second slide, with any luck, superimposes the demand. Unfortunately, demand is not very elastic. It's not very flexible. The vertical line labeled demand against the merit order supply, and it determines what the price is that needs to be offered in order to elicit a quantity of production sufficient to meet the projected demand. And this is a 24-hour ahead market. Effectively, MISO, the Midwest System Operator, accepts all bids at or below this marginal cost of meeting demand and pays the accepted bids the market clearing price. Okay. So next slide. Okay. The third slide shows the effect of introducing significant quantities of renewable power. And here's where it gets a little counterintuitive. On a strict merit order basis, wind and solar power will rank first, since they incur very low operating costs or marginal costs. Once these are installed, the technologies are largely automaton. There are no fuel expenses and only minor maintenance expenses involved in keeping them running. As a result, when the bidding process elicits marginal cost information for the day-ahead market, the entire supply schedule, when these renewables are introduced, will be shifted to the right, and the price of wholesale power falls as a result. So is it clear what's going on in this graph? Old price, new price. As a result of the supply schedule, the merit order supply schedule shifting to the right, we now intersect demand at a lower marginal cost. All right. So as a result, the price of wholesale power winds up coming down. Can we try the next slide, please? So this slide includes the feed-in tariff at a level high enough to recover the capital cost and thus ensure adoption of the technology. So the last slide was a little too good to be true. This one takes into consideration that you have to pay these guys a price to get to induce the investment in the first place. So I hope from this slide the trade-off becomes clearer. So we have the green rectangle representing the subsidy necessary to bring about the investment in the first place, and the yellow representing the savings from driving the from shifting the supply curve right and driving the price down. So we have to compare those two things, and that's an empirical question. That's where the research comes in. And here, let me move to the next slide, please. The next slide cites three recent studies on the question of whether the merit order effects of a feed-in tariff are large enough to recover the costs of the subsidy. These are simulation studies of fully articulated power supply sectors, including balancing costs and ramping costs and many of the things that I've skipped lightly over here. The point I'd like to make is that the Europeans have already conducted much of this basic economic research for the simple reason that they needed to in formulating our own policies now according to our own timetable. I think we can take advantage of some things that are already established by this research community on the other side of the Atlantic. The results slide, please. Okay, so here's the three studies. I've put them together in one graph. The results slide. The research has shown that the feed-in tariff is a policy that has generated actual consumer savings equal to 83% of the cost of the subsidy in Denmark, 134% of the cost of the subsidy in Spain, and 87% of the cost of the subsidy in Germany. Right? And so that's the red columns, the percentage of the cost of the tariff, and the blue columns represent denominated in euros, the average cost reduction of wholesale power as a result of the inclusion of these renewables that weren't there before. Okay? So there is a sort of something for nothing flavor to this. But let me just reiterate that this is peer-reviewed research. We'll go on. Okay, so the most common criticism of the feed-in tariff legislation is that it's too costly. I think the research doesn't bear that out. Specifically, to answer this very specific question of how it drives down costs and how the cost reductions compare to the outlays of the subsidies themselves, the research is showing that this is a policy that very nearly pays for itself. In one case, more than pays for itself. So with that, that concludes my remarks, and thank you for accommodating my travel schedule.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Professor Kildegard? Representative Beard.
Mr. Chairman, is the professor going to be able to come back on the 14th also? Because this is something I think we need to poke at a little bit more. I can pick up on these things pretty quickly, and half of this was right over my head. I'm trying to figure out your X and Y axis, what this then means, and we haven't even begun to talk about what the actual wholesale electricity price is that was reduced by whatever the amount is there in euros. So I know we don't have a lot of time to do that today, but will he be back, or do we have a chance to examine this a little further?
Professor Kildegard?
I would be open to coming back. Yes. If you
coming from Morris? Morris. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
3 hours. You would know. I would know.
Well, Representative Beard, as I said earlier, we are planning on continuing discussion of this bill.
Right.
I think it would be on the 15th,
via
regular scheduled meeting. And
I would also be happy to answer email queries if there's anything specific.
Thank you, and we can communicate further about it. Other questions at this time? Seeing none, it appears, Professor, that this is going to have to soak in a little bit. We appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Mr. Fredrickson, you want to give us a somewhat different perspective, I trust?
Certainly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Frank Fredrickson, and I'm here representing Minnesota Power. I'm a project development leader for Minnesota Power, and my responsibilities as a project development leader are to develop new generation projects based upon their resource availability, technical feasibility, and financial requirements for our utility. A little bit more about my background. Prior to joining Minnesota Power, I worked as a senior product development engineer for 3M Company in Maplewood. And prior to that, my education includes both a bachelor's and master of science in mechanical engineering from the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities, where I emphasized my education on both product and business development. Within your packet that I believe you've been provided, on slide 2, a brief background and overview of Minnesota Power. We're the regional investor-owned utility in northeastern Minnesota. What makes us unique is we have a relatively small retail customer base of 141,000 retail customers. And more than 50% of our energy sales are made up from 12 large industrial customers. Those 12 large industrial customers are all operating in energy-intensive industries, and marginal cost power increases, perhaps such as the 32 cent per household suggested, is going to be much more for those industries, and it's going to be imperative that we keep their costs low so that we can keep our region's economy intact. On slide 3, in my efforts to discuss the proposed feed-in tariff legislation, I want to bring to the front the following 3 questions. Will a feed-in tariff significantly impact the ability to increase renewable generation in the state of Minnesota, to drive renewable development in Minnesota, or to achieve Minnesota's overall energy goals, which include renewable energy, energy conservation, as well as carbon reduction? On slide 4, regarding the first question, we believe that a feed-in tariff is not required to increase renewable energy generation in Minnesota. The existing renewable energy standard policy is requiring utilities such as Minnesota Power to produce 25% of our annual energy from renewable resources by 2025. Minnesota Power started at 7% renewable in 2005, and we have grown that to 11% in 2008. And we plan to continue to grow that renewable energy supply until we meet 25% by 2025, and we're going to do that at the lowest cost to our ratepayers. If we move to slide 5, in my efforts to address the second question I propose is whether or not a feed-in tariff will significantly drive renewable development in Minnesota, I want to begin by providing a background of our nation's renewable fuels, so to speak. These are what we're calling the four W's: wind, water, wood, and wavelength. Or many of you know that as solar power. The maps on slide 5 show the locations of the various resources across our country. As illustrated in the maps, we in Minnesota are fortunate to have a premium wind and biomass resource, but we are unfortunate in that we have only a moderate hydro and moderate solar energy resource when compared to other regions of the country. The premium solar resource exists primarily in the southwestern states, and premium hydro correlates with areas in mountainous regions. On slide 6, I have two corresponding maps showing where wind and solar is being developed across our country. Wind development is focused in the Midwest, and solar development has been focused in the Southwest and some to the East. A couple of key points I'd like to bring out to the committee is that in 2008, the U.S. became the world wind leader. We surpassed Germany in terms of installed capacity of wind generation, and now we have more wind generation than any other country in the world. Regarding solar, utilities alone announced over 1,600 megawatts of photovoltaic solar projects in 2008. That 1,600 megawatt number is significant in that it is more than double of the current installed photovoltaic capacity in the United States today. So what I hope to have shown in this slide is that the development is happening, and it's happening in regions with premium resources where it is more cost effective. On slide 7, to answer the question, we believe that the market is already driving and advancing renewable energy development, and Minnesota is already playing a key role. Those regions in the U.S. with premium resources are driving manufacturing scale-up and technology development for their respective resources. The premium wind resource in our region has already placed Minnesota at the forefront of this technology. Likewise, the premium solar resource in the Southwest is placing that region at the forefront of that technology. On slide 8, I have a table, and I'd like to use this table to address the third question I propose, is how is a feed-in tariff going to impact the ability to achieve Minnesota's overall energy goals, which include renewable, conservation, and carbon. We believe that a feed-in tariff will divert valuable resources away from meeting our overall energy goals. And to illustrate this point, I want for us to consider the increased build-out cost of utilizing solar power in Minnesota versus wind. The table shown has, for various percentages of Minnesota electricity energy sales, what the total megawatt installation would be required for a utility-scale solar facility, capital cost, what that capital breakdown is per capita in the state, versus doing the same amount of energy from a wind generation facility, utility scale, and that capital and per capita generation. I'd like to walk us through the role for 1% renewable energy generation, which would be approximately 670,000 megawatt hours of electricity per year. To meet that need with utility scale solar, it would require 510 megawatts of electricity generation at a cost of nearly $2 billion. That is broken down to approximately $357 per capita. And I want to point out that the numbers I'm using are for utility scale. If this were to be done at a residential scale, that capital cost would roughly double to about $3.5 billion for the same amount of energy. To meet that same 1% of annual energy need from wind, it requires just over 200 megawatts of installed capacity for a cost of approximately $500 million or $100 per capita. And in the rightmost column, what I have calculated is the differential between implementing the two different generation technologies, and it would be an additional $259 per capita to get the same, similar, zero carbon energy on our grids. if we move to slide 9, what I have shown is the Pyramid of Conservation. The Pyramid is a tool that we at Minnesota Power are using to communicate with our customers the priority in which they should apply their efforts toward reducing their energy consumption and thus their carbon footprint. At the bottom of the pyramid are the simplest and most cost-effective solutions, which include habitual changes, followed up with lighting changes, as well as air sealing and simple low-cost but effective means of reducing their consumption in their homes. These items can have a payback of less than 1 year. As we move to the middle of the pyramid, the cost increases and the payback gets longer, more in the 2 to 10 year range. And these activities include replacing their appliances with Energy Star appliances, increased insulation, or improved heating and cooling systems in their households. At the very top of this pyramid is the most expensive and least cost-effective option for a residential customer, and that is adding their own renewable energy generation. These small systems typically have a long payback period in the range of 30 to 50 years, which is often longer than the expected lifetime of the equipment. Our underlying concern at Minnesota Power is that in meeting all of Minnesota's energy goals, a policy like the feed-in tariff is going to take this pyramid and invert it and instruct our customers that the best thing to do is the least cost-effective solution, and that they should not first reduce their energy consumption before they add the high-dollar item. And I hope that I've been able to communicate that there are many things in our households that we need to be doing to first reduce our overall energy consumption. Therefore, once you do that, it is a smaller renewable energy system that you need to install on your household to meet your energy needs. On slide 10, I've included a slide to do a brief comparison. Since Germany is often referenced in the feed-in tariff debate, because they were the first country to bring about a feed-in tariff policy, I'd like to make some comparisons and show why Minnesota is not Germany. First, Germany has high electricity rates. Their base rates are in the 25 to 40 cents per kilowatt hour range. In Minnesota, we have low electricity rates, approximately 8 cents per kilowatt hour. Because their rates are higher, it makes the impact of high cost electricity generation less noticeable in their overall rates. The second point is that Germany has a very advanced energy conservation. At a conference we held in Northfield, a member from Germany was here, and he had pointed out that the average German uses less than half of the electricity of the average American. And as I've shown on the previous conservation pyramid, Minnesotans have a long ways to go in reducing their energy demand before they need to be adding renewable generation. Thirdly, Germany as a country is very densely populated, roughly an order of magnitude more people per square mile than we have in Minnesota. For every 8 people per square mile we have, they have about 80. Germany does not have a single renewable resource that they can rely on to meet their energy goals. As a result of that, Germany has had to develop all of their renewable resources in order to meet their renewable energy goals. Here in Minnesota, we are fortunate, as I pointed out earlier, that we have a premium biomass and premium wind resource at our fingertips. We can exploit those resources and meet all of our renewable energy goals at a low cost. And meeting them at a low cost will keep our economy more competitive in the long run. An example of Germany is that once they develop all of their onshore wind capability, that will only meet 15 to 20% of their energy needs. In Minnesota, we can meet our energy need many times over with just the wind energy within our state. On slide 11, in summary, we feel that a feed-in tariff is not a good fit for Minnesota because of the abundance of low-cost renewable energy generation, and the enabling existing policies are very successful in increasing renewable energy generation in our state. Secondly, Minnesota is already a player in the technology development and the renewable resources that are abundant in our region. And thirdly, continuing policies that promote conservation and emphasize the use of the lowest cost renewable resource maximizes our ability as a state to meet all of Minnesota's renewable energy conservation and carbon reduction goals. And finally, Minnesota Power, we at Minnesota Power are working diligently to minimize the cost of meeting the RES to ensure the long-term competitiveness of our customers as they compete in the global marketplace. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to take any of your questions.
Well, obviously, we are just about out of time. Are there questions for Mr. Fredrickson? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fredrickson, last point that caught my attention was that Germany could only meet 15 to 20% of their renewable energy through onshore wind. Can you quantify that for me, or how did you come to that conclusion?
Mr. Fredrickson.
Thank you. They have, currently you're seeing a reduction in the amount of annual capacity added in Germany of onshore wind capacity. The German Wind Energy Association has already highlighted that they are moving to the offshore wind, which is much more capitally intensive than the onshore wind because they're limited in space and land area. Estimates from the German Wind Energy Association have put it at that 15 to 20% of their energy needs. Currently, what their policy is they are actually repowering existing turbines that are out in the field, so they're deconstructing turbines that may be as young as 10 years old and adding the new larger multi-megawatt turbines in those fields because it's more cost-effective than going offshore.
Mr. Fredrickson, I'm wondering if you have any observations or remarks regarding the testimony we heard just before you from Professor Kjeldegaard.
Yes, sir. How the dispatch works with regards to bringing energy into the market is correct in how that he is mentioning that the marginal cost is driven by the demand. On average, within Minnesota, I looked at the average on-peak energy price for Minnesota over the past, from July 1st, 2007 to July 1st, 2008. The average on-peak energy was at MP.MP was roughly 6.5 cents a kilowatt hour. So that is the average on-peak from in the morning until at night, from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. And the way the dispatch works is going to behave just as Professor Kjeldegaard had mentioned. It's just what I am trying to address is that if we bring those renewable energy generators on at even lower cost, it'll be less of a burden than at the feed-in tariff cost. Major concern that we have is that the feed-in tariff cost will be paying for wind generation in the, I believe it is 8 to 10.5 cents per kilowatt hour range, which is roughly double of what some utility scale generation wind generators are able to bring energy online at. The solar proposed feed-in tariff in the 50 to 65 cent range are roughly 10 times of what we see on average on peak energy. I think it's important, true, that there are hours within the year that we get high energy prices, but it's not $600 or it's not 60 cents a kilowatt hour. At the peak, you may see remote hours or 5 minutes that the market is up near $300. But the reason that we believe you need to compare cost to averages is because what you are doing of that capital cost for a solar energy generator is you are averaging it out over all the hours that it's going to generate throughout the year. And it doesn't pick what day the sun shines, so it's going to be on average a cost of 60 cents, whereas the on-peak market is at 6 cents a kilowatt hour.
Thank you. Is there anything further at this time? Members, we really are going to have to wrap this up. Another committee is scheduled to meet here. Representative Bly.
Well, I just want to ask, you mentioned that if we instituted the feed-in tariff, that it would be a discouragement to conservation efforts, and it didn't seem to be the case in Germany, so I'm not sure that the connection is whether or not we have a feed-in tariff, but perhaps the price of energy is more the key. So I guess I'm not as worried as you are that this policy would do that.
Oddly enough.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, will Mr. Fredrickson be around on the 15th, do you know?
Mr. Fredrickson can answer that, but it's my understanding that he cannot be. I hope that that being the case, we might have someone else from Minnesota Power that could be here in his stead. But Mr. Fredrickson, do you want to respond?
Yes, sir. I apologize, but I have a prior speaking engagement in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. I can look to it to see that somebody else from Minnesota Power is here to represent our position.
Thank you.
Thanks. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.